What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hi, listeners. Grace Anna here, host of Art Muse, a podcast that shares the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art. In doing so, Art Muse aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret these well-known works by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. Each episode focuses our attention on a specific female muse, sharing their important life and legacy. By sharing these women's stories, we are given the opportunity to appreciate artworks from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. Season 3 continues to share the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art, this time focusing on artist models who were also performers in their own right. Season 3 will begin its release this fall. We cannot wait to share these amazing women's stories with you. In the meantime, we hope you continue to enjoy Season 1 and 2 of Art Muse, available on all streaming platforms. Until next time, bye for now.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age and the few years surrounding it. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today, we will be talking about the one-time queen of MGM, Myrna Loy. This episode is dedicated to my grandma, Shirley. She loves Myrna Loy, and she's asked me a couple of times if she's on my list. So up to the top of that list, Myrna Loy went. This one's for you, Grandma. I hope you enjoy her story. Before I dive in, though, I need to give a quick shout out to our newest Patreon member. A huge thank you to Glenda P. for joining our Patreon community. Thank you so much, Glenda. One more super quick thing, and then I promise story time. I'm going to start doing something a little different, for a while at least. I've been releasing 2 episodes for a while now, one with some background and transition music, and one without that I label as sensory sensitive. Being a huge people pleaser, I love being able to provide something for everyone, but I'm just so strapped for time, and I want to be able to put more focus on my research. So I'm going to start doing something that kind of meets in the middle. There will be just one episode that will have very little, very mild transitional music. Not much, I promise. Not overboard at all. So those who can't stand background music, like me, I promise it will be bearable. And no super loud transitions that wake you up when you're trying to sleep. Once I'm able to devote a little more time to post-production, if that day ever comes, I would be happy to go back to doing 2 separate versions and put more time into music again. But honestly, it's the story that matters, isn't it? Not the music. But the music does add some emotion to the stories, and that's kind of grown on me, actually. But for now, just one with very little transition music to add some mild effect. And this way I can focus my energy mostly on my research and the hours of editing that goes in before even adding the music. Thanks for hanging in there with me. Now onto the story of Myrna Loy. My main source of information in sharing Myrna Loy's story with you today is her own memoir, Being and Becoming, a Memoir by Myrna Loy. This book was released in November of 1987, when Miss Loy was 82 years old. Always a very private woman, She was ready to open up a little more now that her days as a high-profile public figure were far behind her. As she put it herself, preserving your privacy becomes far less urgent than sharing your experiences. Myrna Loy was born Myrna Adele Williams on August 2, 1905, in Helena, Montana, to parents David and Adele Williams. The couple welcomed another child when Myrna was two, a little brother named David. And for the first 5 years of Myrna's life, they lived and worked on a ranch near Raidersburg, Montana, in the Crow Creek Valley, a little south of Helena. A couple of years before Myrna was born, her father had served on the Montana House of Representatives, known by all as Honest Dave. He had actually been the youngest man to ever be elected to serve in the Montana State Legislature. Dave and Adele loved their time in Helena, but they were happy to get back to the country where their families had originated and start a family of their own. Myrna recalled wonderful times on the ranch, but her father was left yearning for more of an urban life again like they had had during his time in Congress in the state capitol. So when Myrna was five, the family relocated back to Helena to try something different. Dave dabbled in banking and real estate in Helena, always successful at whatever he did. Gary Cooper grew up on the other side of town. He was a few years older than Myrna, but they grew up there at the same time and had at least one encounter with each other during their childhoods. Myrna yearned to do something good in life. She wanted to become someone who would spend her life helping others. She wanted to be a nurse or a nun. That's how devoted she was to giving her life to helping others. But then her grandma brought her to the theater to see The Bluebird. And that play had her awestruck. It changed her life. She had never seen anything so stunning in her life, and it made her second guess her devotion to a career in caregiving. She wanted to do that. It wasn't nearly as noble as being a nun, Myrna recalled, but it was attractive. The world and the flesh won out, but it took a long time to reconcile myself to the idea of not being noble. Myrna was hooked on performance art. She made a makeshift theater in the cellar of their home, and her very first cellar production was Sleeping Beauty, with a rich cast of neighborhood kids. Myrna designed the set and all the costumes by herself, scavenging what she could from her parents' closet. She was very proud of that grand theatrical debut. When Myrna was 6 years old in 1912, her mother almost died of pneumonia. Terrified of what the rest of that cold Montana winter would do to his wife's delicate lungs, David sent Adele and the children to Southern California. The beach cures all, right? Myrna obviously loved this change of scenery. But all good things must come to an end, as they say. Adele pleaded for Dave to join them so they could all stay in California as a family. But he was a Montana boy through and through. So once the frigid Montana air became tolerable again, he arranged for his family to return. But Adele finagled her way back to her beloved California a short time later when she needed a hysterectomy and convinced her husband LA would be a much safer place to get that done. So back to California she went with the kids, this time to Santa Monica. Once recovered, she enjoyed a social life rich in parties, music, champagne, and jazz. Adele was living her best life, and she would never return to Montana if she had anything to say about it. Which was something women rarely had in those days. A say. It was a good run, but David moved Adele and the kids back to Montana again. Back in Montana, now 8 years old, Myrna began taking dance lessons. Dancing was a big part of her childhood, something she was really good at and something that gave her a wonderful artistic outlet. Her father was not a fan of her love of the theater arts and ballet, but it was her passion, and she was going to pursue it regardless. Like elsewhere all over the world, devastation struck Helena, Montana in the fall of 1918, the Spanish flu. Adele and David Jr. got it first. Myrna and her father took care of them. There were no doctors or nurses available to care for all of the people affected. Many doctors ran from it. Then Myrna got it. Finally, her father got it. Not surprisingly, since he'd been caring for his entire sick family. Everyone recovered from the influenza. Everyone except for Myrna's father, David. David Williams died on November 7th, 1918, when Myrna was only 13 years old. Before the flu had taken over the town and devastated families everywhere, David Williams had planned to enlist in the army and fight in the war. He had told Myrna that he needed her to step up and hold the family together. She was strong and responsible, and he wanted her to be in charge and take care of her mother and brother if he didn't return from war. Well, now the war was over. Her dad never had the chance to enlist. And he was gone anyways. This is what Myrna wrote about life after the loss of her father. Quote, "I worshipped him, you see, worshipped him. I coped with his loss by accepting the responsibility from my mother and brother that he had entrusted to me. I didn't realize for years how much damage this had done. It turned me into the person who had to take care of them. As a matter of fact, too much so, for too long a time. I didn't marry until I was past 30. Years later, when I told an analyst about it, she said, 'What a terrible burden to place on a child.' 'But I wasn't a child,' I protested. 'I was already an adult.' Which, of course, wasn't the case at all. I had just turned 13. End quote. So, with very little warning, Myrna Loy was forced to leave most of her rich and adventurous childhood behind and become a responsible adult at the age of 13. I don't think her father really expected her to make such a huge sacrifice. To essentially sacrifice the rest of her childhood. But she was very devoted to her father, and she wanted to honor his memory and follow through with what he had requested of her. She was going to take care of her family. It should come as no surprise that Adele, Myrna, and David moved back to California once through the worst of their grief. This time to Culver City, near Los Angeles. 13-year-old Myrna taught Sunday school at the Presbyterian Church and curated dance recitals in the front yard. The year was 1919, and filmmakers were arriving to the area in droves to set up new studios and bust out silent films. Culver City was home to Hal Roach Studio and MGM, which was just Goldwyn Studio then. Myrna and her friends would climb the fence into the Goldwyn backlot and have all kinds of fun playing with props and film sets. Their dreams were big on that studio lot. Faraway dreams of being movie stars. Myrna had no idea of knowing then just how real those dreams on that MGM lot would become. Myrna attended the Westlake School for Girls and Venice High School, and she continued to take ballet and piano lessons. After several years of dance lessons, she began teaching young children as well. She would spend hours at the library discovering the greatest classics. She filled her time feeding her mind and soul with the things that made her happy. Before long, Myrna's aunt and cousin joined the family in California. It was a big, happy family. Myrna's uncle had also passed away unexpectedly, so the women and children were doing their best together to make it through to the other side. Myrna's mother was very involved in the music and arts world of LA, and she made many great connections in doing so. She was actually involved in the creation of the Hollywood Bowl. Adele was preoccupied often with her own interests, as well as with visits back to Montana. I assume David Sr. had known this would be a likely case, and this is why he asked Myrna to be the rock that held the family together. To be the consistent one. This responsibility is also what caused Myrna to leave high school before graduating. She had to work full-time to support her family. She was 18 when she left school, so close to finishing. If she had to work more, though, she was going to make that work centered around dancing. Myrna immediately got hired to join a dance team that did prologues at movie theaters, and she was paid $35 per week, which would be about $660 per week today. Movies would include live performances at the theater before the film began or during intermissions between short films, so this is what Myrna was doing. They would often base their performance around the theme of the movie. For instance, they performed a dance before Cecil B. DeMille's Ten Commandments, so they did a beautiful routine that supported the biblical background of the film. The theater that became their home was Sid Grauman's Egyptian Theater. When Myrna Loy was presented the honor of putting her foot and handprints in the cement at Grauman's Chinese Theater, she wrote in the cement, "To Sid, who gave me my first job." Myrna Loy was not impressed with the world of movies. She loved dancing before them on the stage, but she had zero interest in appearing in them. She did a couple times, though, when producers asked the dance ensemble to appear in scenes in their films. She wasn't impressed with her film studio experience at all, or being featured on the silver screen. She just wanted to dance on stage. But that outlook began to change a little when a few prominent men took notice. One was Rudolph Valentino, who noticed her at the Egyptian Theater and wanted to test her for a film. She didn't get the part, but it did leave her a little excited. Next, who noticed her was a casting director at MGM, who picked her up as an extra in Ben-Hur, followed by a chorus girl part in Pretty Ladies. Joan Crawford was also a young extra in this film with her, and they didn't know it at the time, but both would go on to be huge stars at that studio. She and Joan Crawford, who was still Lucille LeSueur at the time, became really good friends. Joan Crawford would be a star very soon. Myrna Loy, she would have to wait a little bit. Myrna was actually still Myrna Williams during this period. Like her mother, she was traveling in very artistic circles. Some of her friends told her that she needed to scrap the Williams name and go with something more gripping, less ordinary. As the group was tossing out every name that came to their minds, Myrna's friend, Russian writer Peter Rurik, blurted out, "Loy, Myrna Loy." Armed with a shiny new name, Myrna Loy's photographs traveled through hands in the business in the most perfect procession, landing in the hands that would pave her path to stardom. Jack Warner. When he saw photos of Myrna Loy, he said, "Sign her, fast." Myrna Loy was signed to a 7-year contract with Warner Brothers Studio on July 13, 1925. Her initial contract paid $75 per week, or almost $1,400 per week today. If she did well, she would get a $25 per week raise every 6 months. This was really good money to a girl like Myrna Loy in that day. She appeared in picture after picture, mostly playing nefarious exotic type characters. She played Filipino, she played Chinese, she played Native American, she played Mexican. She played an Indian princess, and she played in blackface, which she was later horrified by. This is what they did back then. One of the films she played a Chinese woman in, Crimson City, she played aside actual Chinese actress Anna May Wong. Myrna recalled later, "Up against her, I looked about as Chinese as Raggedy Ann." Myrna Loy was part of one of the most significant moments in film history when she appeared in The Jazz Singer in 1927. This, of course, was the first feature-length motion picture with talking sequences. Her scenes were silent, but she was present to hear Al Jolson present the film industry's very first talking and singing sequence. And with The Jazz Singer, the entire industry was about to transform. It would be a transition, though, Some filmmakers were sure that talking films would not take off. Silent films were successful and more than adequate. People loved them. The world would not accept talking films. But some studios knew this was it. The transition, for those of them taking the risk, was to incorporate dialogue into portions of the film, but not all at first. Half-talkies, they called them. Ease into this wild transition. Many film careers ended during this transition period. Many big film stars were sent packing once their voice was needed. If their voice or their accent wasn't good, they were no longer needed. Myrna Loy survived the transition. Myrna Loy was a busy contract actress at Warner Brothers, and she had very little time for socializing. What socializing she did, though, she tried to keep far separated from the business. She declined the publicity dates that she was urged to go on. She didn't go out on the town with the other actors and actresses, and she rarely dated fellow actors. She said, quote, "A lot of those guys, those so-called heartthrobs, were boring. Just plain dull," end quote. Just 2 years after this grand transformation into talkies in Hollywood, the stock market crashed and everything changed. Many film contracts were broken in the aftermath of the crash as film studios scrambled to stay afloat, including Myrna Loy's. She was let go from Warner Brothers in 1930. Talent agent extraordinaire Minna Wallace was there to help Myrna when the whole world seemed to be falling apart around her. She kept her employed as a freelance actress, one of them at MGM for the movie The Devil to Pay, which introduced her to Sam Goldwyn's production supervisor, Arthur Hornblow. More on him in a bit. But Minna Wallace had no issues finding freelance work for Myrna Loy. "I don't think I sent Myrna anywhere that didn't take her," Wallace recalled. "I must say, everybody who saw her wanted to use her. You didn't have to force her down their throats. No matter how small the part, she got noticed, but I felt she needed a strong studio behind her." Enter MGM again, this time with a shiny studio contract. It was 1931. And 26-year-old Myrna Loy was now under contract with the biggest and best film studio in the world, and about to enter into a grand romance with producer Arthur Hornblow. Arthur Hornblow had been married when he and Myrna Loy first met the year prior. Well, he was still married, but he was separated at least. A whirlwind romance began. And at the same time, Myrna Loy was finally being properly showcased on screen. She appeared in 15 films in under 2 years. She was exhausted, but extremely grateful to have such great work during the Great Depression. And she realized something during this time. She was funny. Myrna Loy was first paired up with William Powell in the spring of 1934, a love triangle story between Myrna Loy, William Powell, and Clark Gable. What a place to be. Myrna and Clark didn't jive too well at first. She had recently pushed off a sexual advance from him, and she said ever since that incident, he had been very cold to her. But William Powell... well, she jived very well with him. And the execs at MGM saw it too. The story of how Myrna Loy and William Powell met is really cute, so I want to share it with you. They had no formal introduction before shooting their first scene together in Manhattan Melodrama. The scene involved Myrna running through a crowd and into a strange car. She followed the instructions of the scene, opened the car door, jumped in, and landed smack dab on William Powell's lap. He looked up at her, grinned, and said, "Miss Loy, I presume?" To which she replied, "Mr. Powell." And that is the story of how one of the greatest movie couplings of all time first met. Myrna Loy almost didn't appear in the Thin Man series with William Powell, Not if Louis B. Mayer had anything to say about it. But director Woody Van Dyke threatened to walk away from the project if he couldn't have Myrna Loy. Mayer finally agreed, and the world was presented with William Powell and Myrna Loy for six wonderfully entertaining Thin Man movies. The original Thin Man movie in 1934 was busted out very quickly. It was filmed in just 16 days. It really wasn't intended to be a hit. It was intended to be an MGM quickie with very little fanfare, almost a B-film. Boy, was everyone surprised with what really happened. Myrna Loy had made about 80 films by this point, but she wasn't a super famous star. She was doing okay, but she hadn't quite made it all the way. The Thin Man changed that. She had made it. This was the one. And not only that, but the chemistry between her and William Powell was felt by every single person who saw them together. The duo of Powell and Loy was set in stone. They became a very high priority at MGM. That chemistry between them was very real, but nothing ever came of it behind the scenes, nothing romantic at least. According to Myrna, they both had little crushes on each other, sometimes heavier than others, but they were never anything more than just great friends. Plus, she was still with Arthur Hornblow, and she was a one-man woman. William Powell later gave a really lovely statement about his relationship with Myrna Loy. I'm going to read it to you now. He said, quote, "Even my best friends never fail to tell me that the smartest thing I ever did was marry Myrna Loy on the screen. And it was the pleasantest, I might add. We were married in 13 pictures, and I never saw Myrna go into a temperamental tantrum, rave and rant, or walk off the set in a huff. She never lets her emotions come too near the surface, and remains calm and poised in the most difficult situations. There were days on the set when she liked to sit alone, and other days when she felt rowdy-dow and wanted to play pranks. When we did a scene together, we forgot about technique, camera angles, and microphones. We were just two people in perfect harmony. Myrna, unlike some actresses who think only of themselves, has the happy faculty of being able to listen while the other fellow says his lines. She has the give and take of acting that brings out the best. The Thin Man would never have been a success without her. When the bed rolled beneath her in the hangover scene and she looked up at me with the ice bag on her head and said, 'You pushed me,' she became every man's dream of what a wife should be. Beautiful and glamorous with a sense of humor, provocative and feminine without being saccharine or sharp. A perfect gal who never lost her temper, jumped at conclusions, or nagged a guy. Men must marry Myrna clubs were formed. Hardy Nigel Bruce broke down and wrote her his first fan letter. Jimmy Stewart said, 'I shall only marry Myrna Loy,' while women wept." End quote. Needless to say, William Powell and pretty much the rest of America were pretty big fans of Myrna Loy. Myrna and Bill immediately did another movie together, Evelyn Prentice. MGM had to capitalize on their success in The Thin Man. Her salary had spiked to $1,500 per week now, or $36,000 per week today. And she was grateful for this success, but she knew it was much lower than stars of the same caliber. Mostly, though, she knew that her friend and co-star, William Powell, was making twice what she was making, for essentially the same work. And she wasn't okay with this. She asked for more money, and she was turned down. So she walked out. She did more than walk out. She sailed out. She went to Europe. Screw MGM, she thought. Circling back to Arthur Hornblow again. They'd been together for a few years now, so why hadn't they gotten married yet? Well, he was still married. He told Myrna that he had been trying to get a divorce from his wife, but she was making it so difficult for him. His wife later told Myrna, they became friends later in life, that this wasn't true. He had never even tried. Either way, he was still married but separated, and Myrna had to live a somewhat private romantic life with him. She wanted more. And then she got pregnant. It wasn't ideal, but she hoped maybe this would finally be the thing that pushed him to go all in with her. But it wasn't. She, like so many other actresses in that time, was urged to have an abortion. When Myrna went on strike from MGM, she went to Europe to meet Arthur, who was already there. They could be more free here, and they had the most marvelous time in London, Paris, Budapest, Vienna. It was wonderful, and she put all of the stress of work and being underappreciated for her endless work behind her. She was insanely famous in Europe and was happy to address her excited fans wherever they went. It was marvelous, but she couldn't run forever. She was on a salary freeze until she returned to the U.S. and resolved the issue with the studio. Meanwhile, as a retaliation by the studio to show Myrna that she was replaceable, MGM started putting Louise Reiner and Rosalind Russell in movies with William Powell. Escapade for Louise Reiner and Rendezvous for Rosalind Russell. Myrna didn't cave. And in the end, she won. She wasn't replaceable, as it turned out. The studio gave her the desired salary plus a $25,000 bonus. And then, finally, Arthur Hornblow was ready to end his marriage and start a new one with Myrna. They'd been a couple for 5 years by now. And they finally got married on June 27th, 1936. Myrna was so happy. She had wanted this for so long. Myrna and Arthur built a huge, beautiful house with a pool and tennis courts. And they were constantly entertaining the who's who of Hollywood. Myrna continued to bust out movies left and right for MGM. Some with William Powell, like The Great Ziegfeld, Leibold Lady, Love Crazy, and Double Wedding, but most without William Powell. The second Thin Man movie, After the Thin Man, was made 2 years after the first one. Then came another Thin Man in 1939, Shadow of a Thin Man in 1941, The Thin Man Goes Home in 1944, and Song of the Thin Man in 1947. Although she is known greatly for her partnership with William Powell, just to put it into perspective, in the time between the first and third Thin Man movies, so about 4 years, she had made 20 films. She was kept very, very busy at MGM. She was also paired up with Clark Gable often. They did 7 films together. And together, they became the king and queen of MGM in the late 1930s. Although they had started off on the wrong foot all those years ago, they had become great friends. Myrna Loy and William Powell were paired up and filming Double Wedding in 1937 when a shocking heartbreak hit them both. Jean Harlow died at only 26 years old. William Powell had been dating her for a few years, and she was so madly in love with him, and he with her. Through that relationship, Myrna Loy became very close to Jean as well. In fact, she had desperately tried to get Jean medical help. Everybody could see that something was seriously wrong with her. But Jean's controlling mother and her strict Christian Science beliefs were too strong. Jean could have been saved, and Myrna was left with a lot of guilt over this. And William Powell felt immense guilt for not marrying Jean when she had so desperately wanted to. If he had, he thought, he could have kept her away from her mother, and she would have gotten the care that she needed. So here they were, Myrna and Bill, in the middle of making a slapstick comedy while living with the grief, heartache, guilt, and anger over their loved one's shocking death. It was really difficult for both of them. Myrna was at the height of her success in the late 1930s, a huge MGM star at the height of MGM power and magic. I'm going to skip over much of Myrna Loy's films and career going forward. My focus lies mostly in the lives behind the scenes. I've received a couple of comments about movies that I haven't mentioned in these life stories, so I just wanted to throw out a quick reminder that I'm not really here to talk about career accomplishments as much as I am about human nature and how these lives unfolded outside of work. If you are interested in learning the details of Myrna Loy's work, her autobiography is packed full of amazing info, so I highly recommend reading that if you're interested in learning more about her films. But today, through my voice, you'll be hearing mostly about the Myrna Loy away from the studio. I mean, she said it herself in her autobiography. My relationships were more important than my career. The first few years of the 1940s were pivotal years for Myrna Loy. She was 35 years old in 1940, and a lot was about to change in her life. First, the House Un-American Activities Committee was causing a stir in Hollywood and had everyone on edge. Even more scary, Myrna had landed herself in Hitler's little black book of blacklisted individuals, banning all of her films from Germany. All because she had sent a wire of support to the Czechoslovakia leader after the Nazis invaded the country. Hitler didn't miss a beat, so when he found that out, onto the blacklist Myrna Loy goes. Then her dear friend and regular co-star William Powell was diagnosed with cancer and fought a harsh two-year battle with it. He underwent an experimental treatment and surgery, and luckily he went into remission and was able to live a long life afterwards. But the diagnosis and treatment was, of course, covered up by the studio, and his absence from the movies was attributed to something much more minor. So that stirred up Myrna's life a little bit during that time, too. And then, back to Hitler, the war in Europe was a cause of great stress to many Americans, even before the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Myrna was involved with many other Hollywood figures in raising money for the British war effort. A huge benefit was held at the Coconut Grove, and it sounds like it was a hoot of a time. Myrna, along with Claudette Colbert, Annabella, and Maureen O'Sullivan, worked as cigarette girls at the event. At another benefit, Myrna sold peanuts with Cary Grant and Charles Boyer. Myrna also put in a lot of time doing radio broadcasts during this time. One Lux Radio Theater broadcast that she and William Powell did earned them $10,000. They immediately handed every last cent of it over to the Red Cross. Stars came together with their pocketbooks and made sure that one fully equipped ambulance was sent to the British Red Cross every single week. It was her marriage that was the most difficult thing during this time, though. In November of 1940, she first left her husband, Arthur Hornblow. "It's the hardest thing I've ever had to do," she said. "I loved him. Of all the men in my life, he was the one. But I couldn't live with him." Myrna attempted to leave Arthur a few times, but her heart kept pushing her back. But she knew she had to leave. When she did so very quietly. She didn't want a big thing made out of this by the press. But nosy Nellie Luella Parsons had quite a sniffer on her, and she could smell scandal a mile away. She made sure everyone knew about this split. Myrna said what ultimately made her leave was the negativity surrounding Arthur. She said he was very critical, not just of her, but of everyone. "He put everyone down," she said. "Friends, servants, colleagues. He became a very difficult man, fastidious to the point of mania. Everything had to be perfect. Well, that's generally true of most artists. It's true of me as far as my work goes, but it isn't true of me in my private life. It became an obsession with him. One day, I saw him sticking little pieces of tape under the figurines of the mantle so the maid would place them exactly where he wanted them. After a while, you get to the point where nothing's ever right. Everything you do is put down. I guess I was a hard one to get down, but he finally succeeded." Myrna had been with Arthur for about a decade. This was a really difficult thing for her to do, but she had to do it for her own emotional well-being. She knew it would be really hard, but if she could just get through the worst of it, it would be worth the pain. Like I said, it took her a few times to have the strength to make the separation stick. Arthur didn't make leaving easy for her. You know how it goes. He would turn on his charm and lure her back, and everything would be in the honeymoon phase again. But then came the rest of the cycle all over again. But she was finally able to gather the strength to leave for good. The U.S. entered World War II in December of 1941 after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and Hollywood went into action immediately. Those who were already supporting the British war effort were already in the game, and then almost everyone else in the business joined the cause. Some even enlisted. Those back home did everything from fundraisers to hospital tours to bond rallies to USO shows. When Carol Lombard died in a plane crash while returning from a war bond tour, it made everyone band together even tighter. It was the spring of 1942 when Myrna's divorce was final. Before the divorce was even final, though, Myrna was being pursued heavily by John Hertz Jr. Yeah, that Hertz family. He was part of one of the richest families in the U.S. and had been an acquaintance of Arthur's. That's how he met Myrna. As soon as she was single, he made his move. And it worked. Still going through the emotional whirlwind upon the ending of her relationship with Arthur Hornblow, Myrna Loy impulsively married John Hertz Jr. just 6 days after her divorce. In this new marriage, Myrna was now at the center of New York high society, when she wasn't needed in Hollywood, that is. Things weren't as bubbly as they seemed with her new husband, John Hertz Jr. He was a schmoozer, and he schmoozed Myrna just as well as he schmoozed people in his business world. She quickly realized that she had married a, quote, rather neurotic person, as she put it. He had a violent temper and was extremely possessive of her. He was insanely jealous of her friendship with William Powell and angrily accused them of having an affair. He resented her success as an actress. He wanted a submissive, dependent wife. He did not like her strength and independence. He went into terrifying rages, especially when he was drinking, and he drank a lot. Even a psychiatrist told Myrna, "Your husband is insane." She had made a terrible mistake in falling into his trap. He completely took advantage of her emotional state at the ending of her marriage to Arthur. Myrna left. Several years down the road, John shot at his nurse for not getting to him promptly enough. Myrna escaped a very dangerous situation. The marriage was over within 2 years of its start. Another great change in Myrna Loy's life in the first half of the 1940s was her departure from MGM in 1944, after a 13-year relationship with the studio. She was making $3,500 per week by this point. That would be over $64,000 per week today. But she felt she was only being held on to for the Thin Man movies. A new crew of actresses were the stars of MGM. Women like Lana Turner, Ava Gardner, and Greer Garson. And Myrna felt it was just time to close that chapter and hand over the reins to them. She was happy to leave the demands of being under contract with the Grand Dream Factory. Myrna wrote, quote, "When I say it was a factory, it was a factory. You walked onto the set and people were still hammering and putting things together. There was actually no glamour, just damned hard work. You got up when the only other creatures stirring were the wild foxes that came down from the hills to rifle garbage cans. Even my servants were sleeping because they were needed at night. I became an agricultural authority during those rides to the studio. The only thing on the radio was the farm report. You reported for makeup by 7, sat under the dryer and dealt with wardrobe, then went to the set at 9. You got up there on the set and you had to create, to sustain a performance within the strictures of cables and lighting and camera setups until noon. After an hour for lunch, when maybe you got to get out of your costume, or maybe you didn't because it took too long to put on again, you went back and worked straight through until 6. I don't want to discourage at all. Being a part of Hollywood's golden age had its wonderful aspects, too. There was a satisfaction of being productive, professional, and totally involved, and being paid well for it besides. There was a pleasure of working with so many talented people and associating with so many beautiful ones. That was the norm in those days. You had to be a beautiful woman. You had to be a handsome man. But so far as it being inherently glamorous, it was not. The ones who got caught up in that myth didn't survive it. People who live what they call normal lives don't believe this because they have been taken in by all the glamour stuff. But that's the truth behind it. End quote. I know none of us want to hear it, and we all know that is the truth behind the glamour and the magic, but that's really the reality of it. Louis B. Mayer was so careful about curating his perfectly manicured dream world that we have a very hard time accepting the truth behind the scenes sometimes. Myrna Loy got out a lucky one. Many did not. Look at Judy Garland and Hedy Lamarr. Myrna continued to make films after MGM, including her proudest film, 1946's The Best Years of Our Lives, and the last Thin Man film, just not under a strict studio contract. She would work alongside Cary Grant, Frederick March, Robert Mitchum, Olivia de Havilland, and so many more greats. She was still rockin'. I'm going to breeze a little quicker through Myrna's life now post-MGM. Otherwise, we will be here all day. Myrna allowed herself to cool down a little longer after her second divorce before jumping into another romantic relationship. Hard lesson learned. Let the heart heal first. In 1945, she began dating producer and screenwriter Gene Markey. Gene was the ex-husband of both Joan Bennett and Hedy Lamarr. Gene was lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy and had returned very sick from the war. Myrna nursed him back to health, and they fell in love. Myrna and Gene were married on January 3, 1946, in a full naval ceremony. Myrna was very heavily involved in politics, a proud Democrat and a good friend of Eleanor Roosevelt. So when the Red Scare hit, she was one of the first ones they went after. Many on the left, especially if outspoken, were targeted. Myrna put it like this in her autobiography. Quote, "In those days, people thought, and still do, that liberal meant communist. To me, a liberal is one who moves slightly left when the fascists get too strong, and slightly right when the communists get too pushy. A real liberal has to be flexible that way. Frankly, nobody could be more anti-communism in its present form than I am. I believe in liberality of thought and have no time for any kind of totalitarianism, be right or left." End quote. The Hollywood Reporter included Myrna Loy's name in an article pretty much claiming her to be a communist. So, she sued them for libel. She won, and the Hollywood Reporter printed a front page retraction. Don't mess with that girl. In 1947, Myrna Loy became one of the founding members of the Committee for the First Amendment in defense of the actions by the House Un-American Activities Committee. The following year, she became the first Hollywood celebrity to join the U.S. National Commission for UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. In 1950, her marriage to Gene Mackey ended after 4 years. She recalled never really being in love with him. She liked him and she loved being with him, but she never loved him like she had loved Arthur Hornblow. Gene was a good man, but he had one pretty strong fault. He couldn't resist other women. The humiliation of this was too much for Myrna, so she left. She was too good for that. 1950 was also the year she starred in a massive box office hit, Cheaper by the Dozen. She also met what would become her fourth and final husband, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, Howland Sargent, who she met through her political work. They got married in June of 1951, again not long after her last divorce. With this marriage, Myrna embarked in a new life in Washington, D.C., and she immersed herself even deeper into politics. They remained married until 1960. It turned out Howard wanted a dutiful little wife, too. He wanted solid gender roles in their life together, hers being a submissive wife who looked pretty and served him. And that just wasn't Myrna Loy. She was pretty, but she wasn't going to be any man's servant. After her divorce, she developed a very deep and loving relationship with actor Roddy McDowall, and she focused all of her emotional energy to him and other dear friends like Montgomery Clift. Myrna continued her political efforts throughout the 1950s and 1960s. She became the co-chair of the Advisory Council of the National Committee Against Discrimination of Housing, and then in 1960, she publicly supported John F. Kennedy on his campaign trail, and then Eugene McCarthy in 1968. She was heavily involved in the civil rights and women's rights movements. During the 1960s, she also made the transition over to television as well, guest starring on many shows and starring in television movies. It was either be a Hollywood has-been, ancient in film studios' eyes, or keep busy and happy with television work. She also did stage acting in a few very successful plays. The little girl who put on plays in the yard and cellar had made it to Broadway. She still did Hollywood movies, but she spread her talents elsewhere too. In 1975, she appeared in the star-studded hit Airport 75, the sequel to the Ross Hunter blockbuster Airport. That same year, at the age of 70, Myrna was diagnosed with breast cancer, which she beat. As for romance, here's what Myrna wrote towards the end of her 1987 autobiography when she was 82 years old. Quote, "My romantic life, so to speak, has not been entirely eclipsed by work. You go on having crushes until you die. I'm not going to tell you who they are. I wouldn't dare. Maybe they don't last long, but that part of you doesn't just turn off." End quote. Myrna dated, but she never let herself commit fully to a man again. She'd learned that lesson the hard way, four times. She had her fun, but she was content with herself. She would never call herself an independent woman, but she was an independent woman, and she was content in not sharing her life completely with a partner. Yes, she missed having a husband or partner sometimes, but she was just fine living without one. Reminiscing on her four marriages, she had a positive outlook. She said that she gained something from each marriage. She had no regrets. "I don't look back and mourn their loss," she wrote, referring to the loss of her marriages, "because so many things afterwards were just as terrific." Myrna Loy was never nominated for an Academy Award in all of her years of amazing work. In 1991, she received the great honor of being awarded an honorary Academy Award for her outstanding career achievements. She was 85 years old. Her acceptance speech was given from her home in New York, and it was the last public appearance that she would ever make. And she looked beautiful. Myrna Loy wrote the following in her autobiography. Quote, "If you live long enough and fight hard enough, a sense of comforting continuity comes. I think I can say, without sounding too presumptuous, that something came of my work for peace, freedom, and justice. It is difficult for an American to imagine, but freedom, too, needs reaffirmation. End quote. And that, much greater than her long-applauded film career, is what Myrna Loy was most proud of. She was proud of being a champion for peace, equal rights, and good. Myrna Loy died on December 14, 1993, during a surgery following a long illness. She was 88 years old, and what a trail of greatness she left behind. And now, as I wipe tears from my eyes, I want to share a few more things I learned during my research. Bullet point number one. Myrna Loy's mother was featured on the cover of Field & Stream magazine in 1905, when she was 7 months pregnant with Myrna. She was featured for being the first woman to backpack through the highest points of the Grand Tetons and Southern Rockies. That's pretty cool. Bullet point number two. Myrna's father fell in love with the name Myrna before she was born. He was traveling by train and went through a small station named Myrna. It was a fight against his wife and mother-in-law to name the baby Myrna, but he won them over in the end. Bullet point number three. Asta, the famous dog in the Thin Man movies, was played by several different wire-haired terriers over the years. Bill and Myrna were ordered to not become friendly with any of them because it would mess with the dog's concentration. The first dog actor to play Asta was a dog named Skippy, and he and Myrna did not get along the greatest. He bit her, and she held a big grudge. Bullet point number four. Women flocked to cosmetic surgeons to get a Myrna Loy nose and profile. When Myrna herself saw a surgeon to inquire about having her ears done, she'd been ridiculed by MGM for years to have them fixed so they didn't have to keep taping them back all the time. The surgeon started taking tons of pictures of her all over at all different angles. She was there for her ears. What was he doing? Well, he finally confessed that he was taking all those pictures of her so he would have something to go by to give the perfect Myrna Loy nose to his patients. Myrna didn't end up having her ears done. In conclusion, Myrna Loy was a strong woman who put her all into everything she felt to be important. Her film career, her relationships, her beliefs, and her political pursuits. She was a child full of ambition and became a woman who put that ambition to use, to good use. She saw issues in our world, and she did what she could to address those issues. She stood up and helped. She wanted equality and kindness. She saw hope, and she clung to it. Myrna Loy was one of the great MGM stars of the glamorous golden age of Hollywood. But that is not where her pride shone the brightest. She was proud of the good that she did for humanity. She was proud of her political contributions. She was proud of being a good person. Please, I encourage you to read her book if you want to learn more details of her contributions to the world or more in-depth stories of her film career. It's a really great memoir. She was an amazing woman. I can now see, Grandma, why you love her so much. Thank you, Myrna Loy. First of all, for giving us the Thin Man movies. There really is nothing like the pairing of Myrna Loy and William Powell. Thank you for seeing the unfairness in the world and actually stepping up to do something about it. Thank you for showing women that they don't have to be pushed around, either in their careers or in their personal relationships. You are a great role model. The world needs more Myrna Loys. And thank you all for listening. Please don't forget to follow the show on Instagram and Facebook, so you can sit back and watch how bad I am at posting things there. And I would be forever grateful if you could leave a positive rating and review where you listen to your podcasts. And you know what else would make me really happy? Share the show on your own social media. Tell your friends about the show. Let's share these amazing stories with as many people as we can. They deserve to be heard. Thanks so much, guys. Have a great rest of your week. My primary source for this episode was Myrna Loy's autobiography, Myrna Loy, Being and Becoming, a memoir by Myrna Loy. And, of course, IMDb.